Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 7.
The best comics in the universe!
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
A few months ago, the website BuzzFeed posted their list of 60 comics everyone should read. And I posted it to Facebook. Dad saw it there. We both thought it was a pretty interesting concept.
And now, here we are talking about it. Their list that they put together, we're going to go through it, and we are going to mention every comic on their list. And to be fair, some of those comics, all that we'll mention is that we mention them.
Yeah. There are quite a few that neither of us had even heard of before this list had come out.
Because theirs is a list of the 60 comics everyone should read, which is different from 60 comic books. They make that distinction very clear. Their list encompasses a wide range of comics, both mainstream and underground. There are some DCs and Marvels on there, but I bet if you added those two together, they're still in the vast minority, because it includes
comic strips, autobiography, graphic novels, not just 22-page serialized comic book stories.
Some of these will have a lot to talk about, I'm sure, and some of them will blow by pretty quickly. But BuzzFeed arranged their list of the 60 comics everyone should read by category. And we'll talk about what some of those categories are. Emily already mentioned what some of those are. But we're going to go through the list alphabetically by title. You ready to tackle it?
Let's do this thing.
First on the list is a volume that I had not heard of called Airtight Garage, but by an artist I had heard of, Mobius. And let me say at the outset that there are a number of foreign titles and foreign artists on this list, and Mobius is the first that falls into that category. I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that one right, but I'm certain as we go through the list, there will be many mangles of pronunciations of books and of titles and of artists, so I apologize in advance. But I'm pretty sure Mobius is how to pronounce that. And my understanding is he was a French underground cartoonist, and I would guess the 70s and the 80s, when Chris Honeywell of Two True Freaks talks about comics, and underground comics is his specialty. He mentions Mobius quite a lot, and I think he's the standard bearer for underground comics of that era. Do you have any knowledge, recollection? Do you know if you've ever even heard the name?
I think I might have heard the name once or twice. I did know he was French, and aside from that, I had no idea. I have never read anything by him, at least not that I can remember. But Airtight Garage looked very interesting. I consider myself a steampunk quite proudly, and it does have that sort of retro-futurism. The main character wears a pith helmet, and there's dirigibles and interesting semi-dystopian style, and it looks very interesting. I'd like to pick it up at some point.
Yeah, I think this is one that, for the underground, out-of-the-mainstream books, actually might be one of the more accessible on this list. Both physically, I would imagine some public libraries would have this particular collection or be able to access it. I don't think it's going to be as obscure as some of the ones that are on this list. I will shout out to the Major Spoilers podcast in episode 543 a couple of weeks ago. They went more in depth on covering Airtight Garage. So what I'm about to say here, I learned from them in full disclosure. And the way the Airtight Garage was originally published was a couple of pages at a time in various underground magazines and fanzines and, you know, very independent retro-punk sort of publication. In some cases, it sounded like even published a few panels at a time in some places. So the idea of assembling it into one volume is interesting, but it's not the most narrative of stories. It's much more about the characters and about the setting and about the themes, and is, from what I understand, as much about an experiment in art and in the form as it is about telling a narrative story. So for me personally, it would probably be one of those things that, kind of like BuzzFeed said, It's probably something I should read, but I don't know that I would necessarily enjoy it.
It's almost like a sort of proto-webcomic. That sort of experimentation and distribution of, as soon as the creator is completed, 5, 6, 7 panels or 2 or 3 pages, rather than waiting for any sort of narrative arc to release it, just going, well, this is what I've got, here you go. And in a week or two, you'll get a few pages more. And a month from now, you'll get 5 panels. And that's just really interesting. It's important for those of us who either complain or laud the current trend in distribution for comics and webcomics, that this was going on back in the old days before the YouTubes and the Pirate Bays and the interwebs. There were people that were still distributing their comics like this, just on a much smaller scale.
Number 2, Akira by Katsuhiro Otomo. What I know about Akira is that I've seen that name before. I've heard of it. I'm not sure I've heard of it in terms of a comic. I think I've heard of it in terms of an animation or a collection or a book or in more than one context. You know a little bit more about the Japanese pop culture scene than I do. So tell me just a little bit that you know about Akira.
It's sort of serendipitous the way that this list has come out, that Akira is sort of in a very loose association the Japanese version of Airtight Garage. A lot of manga are released in those sorts of shonen jumps and things like that, of magazines that would collect 5 to maybe 20 pages max from a story and publish 5 or 6 stories a month. So that was the way that the story was originally released. I don't remember which magazine it particularly was from. Then it was later collected into volumes and released as a manga. That manga was then adapted into a couple of OVAs, which is original video animation. Think of an OVA as sort of like a mini series in a comic, that it's a couple of episodes that vary in length to tell the story, basically however the creator and the animation company wants to. It was also adapted into a movie. I think it was also adapted into a live-action movie. May have gotten a full TV series at one point with more than 5 or 6 episodes. So it's possible to have seen a lot of things that are called Akira. Most of them are based on this comic series. I won't say all, but most.
It's interesting the way you described how it came out, and a little bit with Airtight Garage as well. That actually harkens back to some things that I'm learning from Mike Voiles on Mike's amazing podcast of DC history.
I really should start listening to that.
What he's doing is he's going through early DC comics, early meaning before Superman.
Yeah.
And what they were doing in comics like Fun Comics and so on, it was an anthology comic, which would cover 1 or 2 pages of 10 or 15 strips.
Really?
And you'd have to wait to the next issue to get the next few pages of the story. And as Mike tells it, in some cases, the to be continued at the bottom of the story was not exactly followed through on all the time.
Oh.
That because of that method of storytelling, some stories would end in the middle and not always get their conclusion. But American mainstream comics have totally moved away from that idea. It's interesting that in some parts of the world that is still the model.
Yeah.
One of the things they did on the BuzzFeed list as well, for each one of the 60 comics everyone should read, they included a, if you like this, you might also like this entry. So they actually mention 120 comics.
We are not going to mention all of those. Doing 60 comics in a couple of episodes is going to be hard enough, let alone 120.
So we are going to mention by name all 60 on the main list, and where appropriate, or where we have some knowledge or interest, we might mention the backup. And on Akira, there was one that Emily wanted to mention.
Yes. Their recommendation for if you liked Akira is Full Metal Alchemist. And I will actually say, read Full Metal Alchemist first. Even though Akira is a very interesting story, it is a very good story, it's also pretty bleak. And I am going to say this, Full Metal Alchemist is not entirely sunshine and roses either. I occasionally tell people that get through the first two volumes, recognize that those are the happiest point, and if you don't want to go downhill from there, just stop there. But it's a very good story. Full Metal Alchemist is part of a weird sort of trend in anime and manga that are a little more Western influenced, that if you look at Full Metal Alchemist, it is set in Europe, or a region that is vaguely analogous to Europe, during the Second World War, and has a lot of influences drawn actually from Westerns, that there is this concept of two heroes roll into this desert town in the middle of nowhere and sort out whatever problems are going on. It's a very interesting concept, as the name implies. It's all about alchemy, but it's people using magic and alchemy in a military sense. And it's very... If you are a fan of any of the things I've just mentioned, if you are a fan of urban fantasy and historical fantasy, and you really want that interesting take on Western events and Western mythology by a Japanese creator, you should absolutely check it out.
We did an episode recently of the Short Box Showcase about adaptations. I'm wondering, in the manga to anime adaptations, do they tend to hew a little closer to the story? Just in your limited experience, it seems like in the U.S. that isn't always the case. I'm curious, because I know of Full Metal Alchemist just from seeing the DVDs at libraries and DVD stores.
Yeah, the adaptations tend to be pretty close. A lot of people recommend Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, which was the second attempt at adapting it. I have issues with it, mostly because of the first four episodes. They basically reveal all of the mystery and things that you don't find out until the end of the first or second volume in the manga, or the seventh or eighth episode in the original TV series. They just come out and do a prologue, basically, and explain everything.
Right.
And then people are still surprised later on, like, oh, you have a metal arm. Why do you have a metal arm? And it's like, well, we saw that three episodes ago. We know why, and now we're just sort of annoyed. Check out Full Metal Alchemist, the original version. Personally, I just think it's not quite as well told. It's not quite as well animated, but you will get a better experience.
Speaking of adaptations, next on the list, number three, All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely, which got the DVD treatment.
Yes.
About a year or two ago, I believe.
I have not yet picked it up.
But we've read some of the comic.
Yes, I have the first issue of All-Star Superman, which was reprinted for Free Comic Book Day a few months ago, last time they did it. I have read it. I enjoyed it. I would like to read the rest of it, but I haven't gotten around to it yet.
To shout out to another podcast, Mike Bailey's Views from the Long Box covered All-Star Superman in episodes 124 and 125, and I'm pretty sure he did both the comics and the DVD in those episodes of his show. In that one, they mention the If You Love It is Astro City by Kurt Busiek, and I'm interested in reading some of that. And that's a series I definitely want to pick up.
I have never heard of that one.
It's one. It was published by a number of independent publishers along the way, and it's currently has been revived and is being published by DC through the Vertigo. Stories are being produced by that. And it's sort of a deconstruction, my understanding is, but not as bleak or harsh as Watchmen or something like that. But it is sort of in that vein.
Okay, interesting.
We will get a chance to talk more about Grant Morrison in particular later on in the list, so we'll hold off on that discussion for right now. Numbers 4 and 5 on the list come from the category of memoir and autobiography, which is one of the categories that I think we're going to be pretty weak on.
Yeah.
On the knowledge of. Number 4 is American Elf by James Kuchalka, and number 5 is American Splendor by Harvey Pekar. And again, I think along with Mobius, Harvey Pekar is one of the superstars of independent or underground comics. And American Splendor got its pop culture recognition about 10 years ago when a movie was made starring Paul Giamatti as Harvey Pekar. And the movie told the story of him as the cartoonist and his life. But since the comic series itself is very autobiographical, it was able to pull in aspects of the comic while it told the biography. It was a very interesting, well-done movie, I thought, and some of the special effects and the imagery, they sort of were able to move in and out of comics and use the comics as a form. So it was a very interesting movie, but that's about all that I'm familiar with American Splendor.
I should track that down at some point.
It's a very good movie.
Yeah, it sounds sort of Naked Lunch-esque, but probably with fewer bugs.
I'm going to say yes to that.
Okay.
Number 6, Aya of Yap City by Marguerite Aubois and Clement Aubry.
I don't speak French, so I'm going to assume that's right.
Number 7. That's about all we have to say about Aya of Yap City, though I'm sure it's very good.
Yeah.
Number 7, Batman, The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller, Janssen, and Varley. This has also been, more recently, been made into a DC animated movie. And this one was so intense, they had to do it in two parts.
Yep.
So what's your impression, thoughts on Dark Knight Returns from what you have either read of it or heard about it?
I am very interested in this. Most of what I know about Batman The Dark Knight Returns is that it vaguely influenced one of my favorite animated series of all time, which is Batman Beyond. That in the first episode, they basically do the first chapter of Dark Knight Returns with Batman getting shot, realizing he's getting too old for this shit, and retiring. Except instead of going into Carrie Kelly becoming Robin and Bruce Wayne coming out of retirement and the social commentary, it goes into the story of Terry McGinnis. But I've always been interested to go and actually read Dark Knight Returns. Unfortunately, the only exposure that I've had to the Dark Knight verse so far was The Dark Knight Strikes Again, the sequel follow-up comic, which is quite terrible. But I am not going to let that influence my feelings about Dark Knight Returns whatsoever. You have it in the back room somewhere, so
Maybe we'll drag it out next year for Batman's 75th anniversary.
Oh, that sounds like an excellent plan.
I also wanted to mention that in addition to this BuzzFeed list, and maybe as a reaction to it, the website Comics Bulletin came out recently with their list of 10 most overrated comic stories, and All-Star Superman was on that list, as was The Dark Knight Returns. And of course, overrated doesn't mean bad necessarily. It just means
that it's on all of these lists.
And I've actually heard some comic book podcasters when they talk about their top 10 lists. Well, of course, Watchmen's on it. Of course, Dark Knight Returns on it, but I'm going to give you 10 others.
Yeah.
So it's really
the top 12 if you leave the sacred cows off.
Exactly. So I did not go into detail on why they thought both All-Star Superman and Dark Knight Returns were overrated, but I think they're very excellent. Some of that may be a reaction against Frank Miller and some of the things he's done
very
more recently,
possibly.
Or as you said, the sequels and some of those things. To me, it definitely belongs on a list like this.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I am a terrible geek. I don't watch Doctor Who, I don't care for anime, I've never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I like Star Wars and Star Trek okay, but I've never really ventured far into the extended universes of either property. Hell, I have never even watched a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I have been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I have been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. To deal with this borderline personality disorder, I started a podcast in 2007 called
Views from Long Lost.
Every 2 weeks, or so, depending on real life, I pick a particular series, or issue, or character, or whatever to talk about, and then I talk about them, because that's kind of the point of a podcast. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I have a guest, like my semi-regular co-host, the irredeemable Shag, or my other semi-regular co-host, Thomas DJ, or with another friend from the podcasting world. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, and from there you can find the iTunes link, the email address, as well as the backlog of episodes.
Views from the Long Box.
A podcast about comics, or a desperate cry for help? You decide. Every other Tuesday, or so, depending on real life, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
In a world where the internet is filled with podcasts of people saying, jingles, it's no agenda.
Adam Curry, John C. Dvorak.
Time again for the team unofficially known as the G2, fighting disinformation and lunacy all across Gitmo Nation.
This is No Agenda.
From the Crackpot Command Center, burrowed in the southwest quadrant of Gitmo Nation East, I'm Adam Curry.
And from the Silicon Valley North, and why am I shouting, I'm asking the other guy, I'm John C. Dvorak.
It's Crackpot and Buzzkill in the morning.
The best podcast in the universe.
Dvorak.org/NA.
Number 8 is Black Hole by Charles Burns. Okay. Number 9 is Blankets by Craig Thompson.
This is where I'm going to jump in, because Craig Thompson is also the writer, artist, creator of Habibi, which I have raved about for, I think, the last 3 episodes, basically. I think that it's an excellent story, and once again, I think that it is actually better than the one that is listed on the 60 comics. Now, Blankets is listed in the memoir and autobiographical section, and that is because that's what it is. However, the story is very similar to Habibi. They both handle a lot of the same themes, which, if you've listened to me talk about Habibi, includes things like the creative process, religious iconography, the effect of religion and society upon one another, gender identity, sexuality, and abuse. So, while Habibi is an incredibly interesting story deconstructing the way those things affect our lives, Blankets is the exact same story, except it actually happened, making the read worthwhile, but incredibly, incredibly uncomfortable. If you're interested in it, more power to you. However, if you think that the themes are interesting and would rather have them examined in a slightly fictionalized narrative, I think Habibi is probably the better of the stories. Blankets came out first and was basically Craig Thompson's way of dealing, and sort of serves as his coping mechanism and springboard for dealing with these issues in his own life. And Habibi is more refined and less immediate, and I'm just coming back to much less uncomfortable.
And my understanding is that both of these were released in total as graphic novels at one point.
Yes, both of them were released in single volumes, and they're both quite massive. Each one will probably take you 3 or 4 hours to read, and think how quickly you can read a 22-page comic, multiply that out. They're huge.
Number 10 on the list is Bone by Jeff Smith, and we give Jeff Smith a special shout-out because he is from Central Ohio, which is where we are.
Statehood pride.
Woohoo! We should mention that Harvey Pekar from American Splendor is from Cleveland, but I forgot to mention that. Statehood pride! Woo-hoo.
Sorry, Cleveland.
A few years ago, I sat down and worked my way through the entire Bone collection, plus a couple of the spinoff titles. And I don't believe Jeff Smith has added to it, so I think I can still say I've read the whole series. Sometimes with volumes like this, you're never quite sure. And you've read some of it as well.
Yeah, I sat down a couple of weeks ago and read the first 2 volumes of Bone, which I found at our local library, right after I read this list, and was like, oh, I should pick those up. They were really good. I enjoyed them a lot.
What I liked about Bone is that it's truly an example of a comics for all ages.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a kid's comic, but it's a comic that anyone can read.
Yes, it's very kid-friendly, but it's not dumb at all.
And it's high action, high adventure, high stakes.
Very entertaining, but also complex stories and motivations. Good stuff.
It is one of those things, because of the stylized nature of the characters, I could see people perhaps being turned off by the almost silliness of the character designs, as well as the family-friendly nature. You may just think that it's just for kids.
Right. But it is an excellent story, and even though I'm only 2 volumes, so 9 chapters, something like that, into it, I'm really enjoying it, and I want to pick up some more as soon as our library gets them. The related comic from the list is a manga called Usagi Yojimbo, which I have only heard of because I have one token furry friend, and he loves this story because it's about a samurai rabbit. So that's all I know. If that sounds interesting, check it out.
Number 11 on the list, Bottomless Belly Button by Dash Shaw. Number 12, Box Office Poison by Alex Robinson. Congratulations, fellas, for making the list.
I have no idea who you are, but apparently you're awesome.
Number 13 is Buddha by Osamu Tezuka.
This is one that I am sort of vaguely aware of, but for a very silly reason. Buddha is a very earnest comic that works to retell the life of Siddhartha Gautama, who would later become the Buddha. And it takes a lot of time to investigate his childhood experiences and what would form him into the man who would create one of the largest world religions to date. It focuses a lot on the philosophy and the religion of Buddhism and how it came to be. And it follows Siddhartha from his birth to his death. It's a very interesting design on the covers, that each one of the covers is of the main character getting ever so slightly older, until in the last one he's a very decrepit old man, and it eventually does end with his death. The reason that I know about this creator and this series is because when I was reading the list and the name Osamu Tezuka popped up, I thought to myself, isn't he the Saint Young Men guy? Saint Young Men deals with some of the same concepts that Buddha does. The premise is Siddhartha Gautama, now become the Buddha, and Jesus Christ of Nazareth are roommates in modern-day Japan. It is ridiculous. It is campy, and it is really, really funny. It was released much later than Buddha, and it is obviously a comedic farce. And it's really weird, but I think it's hilarious. It has both a manga and a couple episodes now of an OVA. If you want to find it, you can find them on the internet if you're interested. Buddha is a very complex and interesting character-driven piece. So is Saint Young Men, but it involves much more jokes about neats.
On the sacrilege scale, Saint Young Men, either for a Buddhist or for a Christian, where would it fall?
If you are easily offended, do not read it. However, Jesus wears a shirt that says 2 fish, 4 loaves equals cool forever. So if that sounds hilarious, which it is, you should read it. Jesus is a blogger who reviews daytime soap operas, and Buddha is his stickler, incredibly conservative, kind of awkward, quiet roommate who can't understand this crazy guy who runs out all night and is really chill and has these animals that follow him everywhere. And they go to an amusement park and the angels show up because Jesus is screaming and try to save him.
And this is why we have independent and underground comics.
Because things like this can happen.
Number 14, Calvin and Hobbes by Bill Watterson.
A classic comic strip that I have not read.
This is an example of what this list does by expanding the definition of comic to not just include manga or underground and independent, but include comic strips in their definition of comics. We'll run across 5 or 6 others. I think Calvin and Hobbes is one of the greats.
It is. I have read a couple strips, occasionally. They'll pop up on Facebook, of the greatest Calvin Hobbes strips and gags of all time, and they're absolutely wonderful. One of these days, I am going to try and pick up the Essential Calvin and Hobbes. Only problem is that because it's out of print, it is something like $300.
We have one or two of the paperbacks in the back room, somewhere around Batman Dark Knight Returns, which they probably shouldn't be that close together.
Eh, whatever. They're next to each other on the list. It's fine.
Well, alphabetically, but thematically and artistically, I don't think so. I don't go to Frank Miller for my sense of humor.
Or your heartfelt earnestness.
Well, I will just say this, and maybe this will mean more to you once you've read more of it, but I take all of my parenting cues from Calvin's dad. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. That might explain so much in a few days.
Number 15 is Clumsy by Jeffrey Brown. Unfamiliar. Number 16 is The Contract with God trilogy by Will Eisner. Now, I'm unfamiliar with The Contract with God trilogy, although the description of it was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But Will Eisner, best known for creating The Spirit back in the early days of comic books. And even though this Contract with God trilogy was later in his career, I think it came out in the 70s, if I'm remembering correctly. But it sounded really interesting. I really like the description of it in the BuzzFeed article. It says that Will Eisner began his comic writing career in 1936 and continued to write and draw comics for the next 60 years, completing his last graphic novel the year before he died. But when he published A Contract with God in 1978, he popularized the term graphic novel and changed comics forever. The Comics Journal called the book, which collects the stories of Jewish tenement dwellers in New York City, their masterpiece of one of the medium's first true artists. So it sounds like a really interesting collection.
It definitely sounds like something that I should check out at some point.
I know at my library at the university, we actually have a couple of dozen graphic novels. I'm not sure if they got a grant to buy them or they had a geek intern who was doing the ordering one semester. I'm not quite sure how it worked. They do not have the Contract with God trilogy, but they do have the first three volumes of the collected Spirit.
Ooh.
And that is definitely something that is on my short to medium list of important books to get around to.
You should check those out and bring them home sometime.
We'll see what we can do. Number 17 on the list is the Brian Michael Bendis run of Daredevil from 2001 to 2005, mostly drawn by Alex Maleev. What do we know about Daredevil?
Almost everything that I know about Daredevil, I have gathered...
If you say the Ben Affleck movie, you're off the podcast forever.
Haven't watched it. But most of what I know about Daredevil, I have picked up from random episodes of podcasts and his various appearance in animated TV shows. I don't even know if he had his own animated TV show or was a main character in any of the animated TV shows. But I think he occasionally popped up in X-Men once or twice. And he was on the Fantastic Four show a couple of times. But, I mean, I really know almost nothing about him. I've read one issue, which was the What If that you reviewed a couple of weeks ago. So that is where my knowledge of the character starts and ends.
I'm not familiar with this run. The if you liked this, you might like this. For this entry, I thought was kind of a cheat. Because they said if you liked the Brian Michael Bendis Daredevil run, you should check out the Frank Miller Daredevil run.
You know.
Including the specifically the Born Again arc. And that I've read. And I think those are great. I think that's Frank Miller really at the height of his powers, doing street-level stuff, Daredevil, Batman. I think he really understands how to tell that type of intense, character-based, street-level story.
Right.
This Bendis run, it was also listed, by the way, on the Comics Bulletin's overrated lists.
So take that as you will.
I didn't even know it was rated at all. Number 18 on the list is another from the memoir and autobiography category, Epileptic by David B.
No idea.
Yeah. Number 19 on the list is the collection Essex County by Jeff Lemire. Now, I'm not familiar with this, but Jeff Lemire has written some highly lauded books for both DC and Marvel. The work of Lemire's that I'm most familiar with is his New 52 work for DC when he did Animal Man. And then he picked up and did some of the later runs of Justice League Dark. I think he did Frankenstein Agent of Shade as well.
Ooh, Frankenstein. That, oh, it's so good.
That was one I really liked. And I talk about Agent of Shade in passing in an upcoming episode of the Quarterbin podcast. So stay on the lookout for that. And I know that Lemire is one of those guys who's bounced back and forth between the big two while also keeping his independent and his creator-owned works. So he's been able to keep a foot in both worlds, both the independent world as well as doing mainstream work for DC. So I think he's a really interesting writer.
Yeah.
Number 20 on the list is Fables. Yes. By Bill Willingham and a whole bunch of artists.
Oh my gosh.
What have you read of Fables?
I think I've read the first three collections, maybe four, something like that. Oh, it's very good. It's very, very, very good. If you haven't read Fables, you really, really should. It's an example of the modern day or quote unquote twisted fairy tale that is just absolutely wonderful. If you like Once Upon a Time, it has been acknowledged freely by the creators that the story and the concept was influenced by Fables.
By the creators.
No, it has been. There have been people at panels who come up to them and go, "So you know this Fables guy?" And he basically did the same thing, and they've gone, "Yeah, yeah, we know. We've read it. We like it. We're doing
a different
similar
thing.
Things, right. But they're not the same."
I think there's some controversy about that, because at some point Willingham was called in and did a pitch. I don't remember if it was to ABC, but did a pitch of Fables to one of the networks.
Ooh.
And he got turned down, and then shortly thereafter, Once Upon a Time came out. So, I mean, I appreciate that the creators acknowledge that as an influence, but say that they're doing something else. I think maybe at the network or executive level, something else might have been going on. And of course, in the last 10 or 12 years, perhaps sparked by Fables, there has been a renaissance of sort of fairy tales being turned on their heads, either into movies from Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yep, your Hansel and Gretel, Jack and the Beanstalk, all of those.
Right, to the Wonderland spinoff now from Once Upon a Time.
Oh,
and Grimm, to some extent, fits into that category as well. On the TV side, it does remind me a little bit, and this is time for our obligatory Babylon 5 reference.
I was going to say, are we gonna diss Deep Space Nine?
I'm just saying that J. Michael Straczynski has a particular story that is, let's just say, similar to Willingham's experience pitching Fables and seeing something else really similar show up on the air.
I'm just going to say this. Regardless of what was going on behind the scenes, at the very least, the creators of Once Upon a Time acknowledged, yeah, we kind of sort of maybe a little bit ripped you off. Sorry about that.
Well, I don't think they said that, but I do think that they understand that they're pulling from similar experiences and similar ideas, and that Fables is probably one of many inspirations for them.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Fables. I've read, between Fables and Jack of Fables, I've probably read over 100 issues through the trades. A big fan. I think what Willingham did there in pulling a world together is just terrific. And,
oh, yeah.
And along with 100 Bullets, which sadly is not on this list,
oof,
those were the two books, 100 Bullets and Fables, that brought me back to comics about 7 or 8 years ago, after having been out of comics for more than a decade. They were the doorways to bring me back to comics a few years ago. So I'm a huge fan of Fables. 21 is another comic strip, The Far Side.
I love The Far Side. Oh my gosh, The Far Side is the greatest thing in the world. It has my favorite comic strip of all time, and I've got it printed out and it's on my wall somewhere.
Let me guess, does it involve cows standing up?
No.
Because that was one of his main themes.
It is. It is one of his many recurring themes, but no, it's my favorite thing ever because I am a sociologist. My favorite gag that he's ever drawn was a bunch of stereotypical native-looking peoples desperately trying to hide their television, dragging their sofa out of the hut as some guy comes running down the street screaming, "Anthropologists! Anthropologists!" It's the best thing that he's ever done, and I love him to death for his wordplay and puns, and it's fabulous. Oh my gosh.
That is eerily similar to his comic strip of the cows standing up, and one of them yells, "Car! Car!" And so they get down on all fours.
Yep, yep.
Very similar concept.
He's a big fan of that whole, the world as it really is, and the world that we perceive, and yeah. It's great. Occasionally dark, always funny. Great stuff.
I don't know if we mentioned this, The Far Side by Gary Larson.
Yes. Sorry. Cut him off. Mr. Larson, you were fabulous, and I love you.
22 on the list is From Hell, written by Alan Moore, with art by Eddie Campbell. This is in the historical fiction category, as this relates to the Jack the Ripper events in Victorian London.
Interesting. I thought that historical fiction was a bit of an odd category to have in this list. That definitely sounds interesting.
The companion piece for this one that BuzzFeed mentioned is V for Vendetta.
Ah.
Which again also has that historical type of feel to it.
Yeah.
Have you seen either of the movies, From Hell or V for Vendetta?
I have seen V for Vendetta and I have not read the book. I am interested in reading the book, V for Vendetta. The movie was odd. I have a friend who likes to consider himself a pseudo-anarchist, and it's his favorite movie of all time. So take that as you will, as a recommendation. I don't think it was that great, but I hear that the book is better.
And the movie From Hell, I believe we would say, was loosely based on
that seems fair.
On the book. Hey guys, it's Professor Allen here. Sorry to interrupt myself and my daughter, but after the fact, Emily and I realized that maybe our listeners are not quite ready for the 2.5 hour recording that this ended up being, though it'll actually be closer to 2 hours once we do some editing to it. We're not quite at the level of the Fire and Water podcast that could just toss out a 4.5 hour episode and expect people to listen to it, or This Week in Tech or No Agenda, which routinely release 2.5 hour episodes. So we're going to go with 3 45-minute episodes or so. Our plan is to release part two of the discussion just 4 or 5 days after part one, and then part three 4 or 5 days after that. So the plan is that these three episodes would be released sequentially in the Relatively Geeky feed, so you'll be able to keep up with the list with any other pesky distractions of us talking about other stuff. So if you have any questions about this list in general, the comics that we've discussed so far, or just anything about this podcast or anything in the feed, send us an email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. We try to reply to the emails pretty quickly, and then at some point in the near future, we're going to have another feedback show. So again, thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. And part two will be coming to you later in the week.